From WXXI News, it is 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith, joined this hour by our co-hosts for the program today, Tariq Spence of WDKX Wake Up Club. And we're continuing our series of programs inspired by the Rochester Museum and Science Center's Race, Are We So Different? We're going to be welcoming our guest, a man who you frequently hear with Tariq during the water cooler segment of his show, Rochester School Board member, attorney, and author Van White, will be with us in moments to talk about the struggles and the frustrations many people, especially African Americans, are still experiencing today, a half century after the March on Washington. And of course, we invite you to join with your thoughts as well. It's as easy as picking up your phone and dialing 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And as we wait for Van White to arrive, Tariq and I are going to continue our conversation, which began just before the program. And I got to admit, at this point, when we're going to talk about Van's book, his latest book, I'm kind of caught in the same pickle as CeeLo Green, because the title of the book is something I can't say on the radio.
Nor can I.
Any more than his Grammy-winning record title could be said on the radio. I can only talk about the shorthand version, F It. And I guess you hear into the calls all the time.
Yeah.
And I will ask Van this when he comes in as well. Is that what a lot of people, especially young African-American people, feel about their lives and their future, that they just throw in their hands and giving up?
The belief system of no matter what I do, I think the system, quote-unquote the system, is against them. And that is how a lot of them feel. I think there comes a point where you get through that and you get to the other side and, you know, you become okay, a productive member of society, and, you know, understanding that there are things out here that we need to talk about. And that's what this is really about when we talk about race, are we so different? But the other end of it is the fear of what is going to happen to me from what I've been told from my family members, from my friends, from, you know, people that I've known growing up. And I think that fear and the things that have been done over the years, you combine those two, and maybe you're running into situations when you're not sure if this is it. Am I being discriminated against? Am I going to get a fair shake? Am I going to be just pushed through the system? And I think that's the fear that some young people have, and even older people. You know, we don't just limit it to just young people. There are, you know, older people in their mid-20s, mid-30s, mid-40s, who feel as if, you know what, I don't think I'm going to get the fair shake that I think every man and woman deserves. And so it leads to the two most dangerous words that not only African-Americans could say, but anybody could say is F it. Because when you get to that point, it becomes I've decided that I don't really care about anything else, and now I'm just going to, you know, go crazy, or I feel like I could go crazy and do whatever I want and wreak havoc on society, which we know doesn't work.
But a lot of people just want to throw up their hands, give up, and I'm sure everybody's had moments like that.
Yeah.
Do people have more of those moments based on where they are? They always say where you stand depends on where you sit. If you're sitting in a place where there's a history of unfairness, are you going to be more likely to see unfairness? Whether or not it actually exists, are you going to be, at least in the part of your mind, expecting it because it's happened in the past, or maybe it happened to your parents, or you know it happened to your grandparents?
And I think that's the ultimate understanding of there's no ultimate answer to what generations have had to deal with is, okay, you know, this may happen, this may not. You have to understand that this is real. But, you know, last week we had a caller that called in and said that, you know, we had a lot of older African-Americans on the show, and they're very upset, or they'll sound angry when talking about issues of racism because of how they felt treated less than, and believe as if, you know, the person who either has the badge or the person who has the robe is going to make these decisions that will ultimately define their life and not do their due diligence and go through every single process of, let's just say, the law. And so that belief that could have them rolled up and packaged and put away into a jail cell for something that wasn't done ethically all the way is a fear. It's a fear that people deal with every day. Every generation has sort of dealt with it. I've had situations where I was in college one time, and I was doing something for the radio station at the college. I had the radio station shirt on. We were giving away tickets to, I think it was a concert. If anybody came up to me and said sort of, you know, as in radio, the freeze that pays, you know what I mean? And a cop stopped over, question. And I just remember, now I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't doing anything illegal. It wasn't, doing anything unethical. It was doing what college radio jocks do, which are these wild little crazy stunts that wasn't even that wild. And I remember him questioning me, and the line of questioning that he gave to me had me nervous to every answer that I gave him. And I remember the program director at the time, who was a teacher, asking me about it. I remember the jock that was on the air asking me about it, and we were able to sort of make me feel better by poking fun at them because they were doing this sort of harassment deal. And I remember my advisor calling the police department to let them know, why would you do that? Why would you go after, you know, a kid who's just doing a college sort of radio, skit where he's giving away tickets? And I just remember that moment of that was it. That was the moment where you didn't see a college student. You saw a young African-American, student standing on a corner wearing a sweater because it's Brockport and it's cold. And you asked him a million questions, and ultimately I was able to walk away from that. But the whole walk from downtown Rochester back to the radio station, I said to myself, and Van White joins us now, I said to myself, Van, that was the moment that African Americans fear the most, when a cop comes up to you, you know you didn't do anything wrong, but you're worried that he will try to pin something on you.
And the thing is, there are other circumstances where you could do something really outrageous and nobody will bother you a bit. It just reminded me of a downtown prank that I remember the radio station I was working for in Syracuse doing.
Yeah.
And when this is some years ago, this is almost 30 years ago, but what they did in the middle of the night was erect a giant fiberglass banana,
mm-hmm.
and had their night personality announce he was going to live in it for the next however many days.
Yeah.
Until somebody called in, somebody answered his phone with the phrase that pays, mm-hmm. and then they were going to get $1,000 for doing that. Yeah. Well, he was there for 8 days. We were just wondering when somebody was actually going to come call the Syracuse cops and bust the whole thing. Nobody ever did.
No cop.
Never saw a cop. There were a lot of people around gathering around the thing, wondering what it was and asking about it and talking about it. It was the talk of the town in a way. No cops. Nothing.
Yeah. No questioning. No, sort of pulled to the side. And it's one of those moments where it happens, Van, and you're not sure how to react. You just know that you have to be very careful with what you say, very careful with what you do, even though you didn't do anything wrong. And that is a scary, scaring feeling of, oh, my goodness, who am I going to deal with today?
Well, there's a considerable amount of stress that's associated with that kind of encounter. And again, it's a regular encounter for African Americans throughout this country. And I know it's difficult for folks to understand. You literally would have to be there. Mm. Hands gripped on the steering wheel, looking in your rearview mirror after that cop stops you, and all you see is those bright lights flashing in your rearview mirror. And then you look to your left and you look in your side view mirror to see if you can get a view of him. And all you see, and they're doing the right thing, because the number one place for fatalities, as I understand, this is what they taught us in
traffic
law school,
stop.
Is traffic stop. Yeah. So the cop's got his hand on the buckle that's above his firearm, right? And that's what you see in your side view mirror. And then you know, because they ask this of every citizen, that you have to go into your glove compartment to get your registration and your insurance card. Now, you know you have to do that, but every black male, every black female, particularly black males, I got to say, know that that's what they have to do. But before they do that, there's that second thought. should I reach into my glove compartment to do what I'm lawfully required to do? Because he might think I'm reaching for something or I'm hiding something. The stress, and again, I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm just telling you the reality of our existence.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
As you reach into that glove compartment, you're worried that is he going to do something, feel he's in danger and he has to do something with that gun. This is the reality of the this is the legacy of profiling. This is the legacy of black men and the relationships that they've had historically with law enforcement. Now, that's not to say that that legacy can't be improved upon, but I think people have to begin with understanding where we're coming from. And simultaneously, people have to understand, people of color have to understand where cops are coming from. Again, as Tariq and I were just talking about last Friday, the number one place, I don't know where he learned it, but I learned it in law school, the number one place where cops are injured on the job is as they stop vehicles. So we have to understand that there's reason for caution. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the color of somebody's skin. Mm-hmm. And they, too, have to understand that there's a historical there's some history here. And also, I should say, if you look at the data, and we don't need to get into it now, there's data that from sea to shining sea, this country and the municipalities in between each coast have records of racial profiling. The Department of Justice tells us this. So this isn't just anecdotal evidence. This isn't just Tariq and Van saying, oh, yeah, this is what happened to me when I was young. Mm-hmm. This is happening to men of color across this country. So I think there has to be understanding on both sides.
And is there an improvement in the climate? Is there less of this rather unfortunate profiling going on right now in Rochester or in any other community in the country? Is it less of a problem, or is it still a serious problem?
I think the data is nationally. I don't know what we're talking about here in Rochester, but I think nationally it's not gone away. And in fact, I think the Department of Justice data tells us it's still a major problem in the United States. Again, from coast to coast. This isn't something that's relegated to the South. This is happening in Northeast cities. This is happening in the West Coast. And I think the Department of Justice data tells us it's still a major problem in this country.
And is it necessarily even more of a relief of tension when the police officer says, sir, do you realize your taillight is out? Or, sir, do you realize you were going 50 in a 30 zone? I'm afraid I'm going to have to write you up.
Well, it depends on how that is resolved. I mean, if your taillight is broken and the cop stops you for, you know, broken taillight, and he writes up a ticket, and that's the end of it, and there's no additional intrusion. He's not asking to, you know, actually get out of the car. He's not asking you to, can he have consent to search your car? Those are additional intrusions which would not be justified. I'm speaking like a lawyer here, I realize that. But they would not be justified. But you don't have to be a lawyer to understand, wait a second, okay, I had a broken taillight, but so why are you in my trunk?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, my bike doesn't have a horn on it. I heard you guys talking about this the other day on the radio. My bike doesn't have a horn on it, but neither does the kid in Brighton. You know, you're 13-year-old and you're riding around and you're stopped in the city of Rochester for not having a bell. A bell. You know, chinga, 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 chinga. Nobody has bells on their bike. No. But they're stopping kids in the city of Rochester for that. And these kids are sophisticated enough. They're not lawyers. They're not Johnny Cochran's. They're not F. Lee Bailey's. They know that an officer perhaps has the legal right to do that, but they are understandably suspicious about why the white kid in Brighton has never asked those questions about the horn or the bell not being on his handlebars, and yet he's being asked. So I think people are sophisticated enough, young and old, to know that there are lawful reasons to stop somebody. But when you go beyond the pale of normal experience, like stopping a kid for not having a bell on his bike, stopping a man for walking. Now listen to this, Bob, and Tariq has heard me say this a million times, for walking the wrong way down a one-way street. Not driving.
You should see
Bob's face. Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah. I've actually represented somebody whose encounter with the police began with that justification. Another kid walking down the street when he should have been walking on the sidewalk. And check this out. It was after a blizzard. So, again, you don't have to go to Harvard, Georgetown, Brockport to figure, wait a second, something's not right here. And that ultimately hurts us all. People in blue and people whose skin happens to be black.
And that does sound absolutely unreasonable. And I never knew that there was such a thing as a law that affected pedestrians walking on a one-way street.
Yep.
And that's a new one.
And, you know, it's interesting, Vin. The great thing about working on the radio and talking to different people and doing interviews, I don't know if I would have gotten as comfortable around police officers if I didn't have to engage with, say, for example, the chief of police or police recruiters that come up to the show all the time. Or maybe we're doing a public service event where you're going to run into officers. And I ask them questions and they ask me questions. And I think over the time, in the years and the years I've graduated from Brockport, it's been over 10 years now, you start to realize, okay, I understand why you're doing what you're doing, but do you understand why I feel the way I feel? And so once we have the dialogue, like we're having right now about race, once we have the dialogue to understand, oh, that's why men of color generationally have been upset about this. That's once you start to realize why people are angry or people are frustrated or people say F it, yeah. Then you start to realize now I get, if I were dealing with that for me 36 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, you get to see it over and over, decade after decade, live it.
Yeah.
You get to see why they get upset.
But see, here's the problem. Most people don't have Tariq and I's experience. They don't have the opportunity to sit down with the chief of police, Jim Shepherd, great guy, very personable, very caring, passionate guy. And all the other police officers that I got to know as a prosecutor or I've got to know in one public function
great
or another.
Officers.
There's great police
great
officers
ones,
out there.
Yeah.
Most people don't have that experience. And this is part of the problem with modern day tensions between people of color and police officers. There's just not the opportunities for positive interactions.
Yeah.
And so, you want to talk about, improving race relations, reducing the tension that exists between police and police and citizens that they serve. I think one of the things you got to talk about, and I don't know if this is a conversation about solutions, but this particular solution has nothing to do with, a Civil Rights Act of 1964, Equal Employment Opportunity Action filing. We've talked about it in the water cooler, and I don't know how much consensus there is in the community, but we ought to go back to the section offices, because what those section officers provided was an opportunity for police and citizens to engage in positive interactions. There was the PAC-TAC teams. There was the CPOs, crime prevention officers. Instead, what happens with these two huge section offices, you've got cops running from scene to scene, problem to problem, 911 call after 911 call, seeing people at their worst and being on the defensive. The greatest thing we could do to improve civil rights in Rochester is give people the right to have a positive interaction with the police officers that are there to serve them.
That suggests really that we ought to rethink how even police officers are deployed.
Absolutely.
Would you basically be going so far as to say we'd have a better relationship if we went back to the old section system or its predecessor, the precinct system of the early 20th century?
Well, I came up when I was a DA, came back to Rochester. It was the section offices. We had Clinton section, Genesee section, Goodman section, downtown section. What else am I missing? Highland section. There's a couple others, I think. And I could rattle off for you. I'm a little bit old now. I could rattle off for you the names of the section captains, Steve Love. What was the guy at the Genesee? He was there for many years, Genesee section. I mean, there were section captains, Captain Werner, I think his name was. I mean, there were section captains who you knew, and they knew you. They knew whether a young man was supposed to be home from school. They knew when the schools opened. They knew when the schools closed. They knew the drug stores in the community. You just can't have that level of interaction if you're assigned to two huge sections and you're responding from call to call to call. Plus, what I've noticed, what they do is they bring in, they have these special operations, they bring in the Monroe County Sheriff's Department, the New York State Troopers, some, momentary detail, and they do all these stops. And these guys don't know these people from Adam or Eve.
Yeah.
And so you don't know if, oh, yeah, that's Tariq, his mom lives down the street. I can talk to her tomorrow. Right?
Yeah. Or I have her number.
Right? That's the kind of neighborhood that we need. And police officers, increasingly, I've noticed, have become less a part of the neighborhood and more part of a detached unit, almost like a military unit that's deployed to a trouble area. That cannot be the way to have positive, productive interactions.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that budget-driven by trying to stretch the number of officers you've got over as wide a space as you can and basically responding, doing a call and response kind of thing to put them where they're needed at the moment? Wasn't this all done the way it is right now when the city started running short on cash?
I think that was Duffy's plan. I think it was to sort of it was done economically for the city and trying to sort of find the best solution possible within the budget that was given. But the other thing too is that is it working? Does the community feel it's working? Or do the officers? I don't know if they've got a chance to sort of sound off. And do they feel it's working? Because I think this is a, we talk about effort. You know, effort isn't just about frustrations in America with young African Americans. Effort could be for anyone, anybody who's doing this job,
police included,
who feel as if, you know what, I'm just here. I just want to go. Which, you know, I want every officer to go home. But I want that young man or young woman or that dad or that mom or whoever to go home as well so that we don't have any casualties in the city of Rochester. I know I'm being, you know, totally optimistic on that. But, you know, that's what I want everybody to go home.
Yeah,
but in a sense that, you know, do we have officers, some, not all, some, that do say F it?
Yeah.
And are they frustrated with the system? Do they want to see a change? I don't know if anybody's asked them how they truly feel about the way they're communicating with the community, because let's face it, that's not an easy job.
Yeah, no,
that's not an easy job, and there's a lot of people that go do it every single day, and you know, have to deal with the community, some good, some bad, every single day.
You know what you've both given me is something to really seriously probe with guests I'm going to have in this studio next week, as it happens. Mayor Richards and Chief Shepherd are going to be here next Tuesday in the noon hour, and I'll be able, as we're talking, I'm sure, at that time about some overall positive signs that we're seeing in crime in this area, about some of the things we need to do to perhaps retool our response and retool the way we deploy people in a more community-sensitive way. You've given me some inspiration as to what we're going to do when we have that discussion next week.
Let me suggest a possible question, and I think an answer to the question that you just presented a few seconds ago. I think Tariq is right. I think Mayor Duffy, former Mayor Duffy, to the extent we can get in his mind, I think what he was trying to accomplish was save money and regain some control over the deployment of police officers. Because, you know, if you were assigned to a certain section office, I think the difficulty was, and I was at the DA's office at the time, is, you know, if you had difficult spots or troubled areas, you couldn't, it was more difficult to move them around given the labor contract. Now, that's just a very quick assessment of what I think he was trying to accomplish. And because of that, it was difficult to logistically, you know, send cops where you need to send them. And also, I think the thought was it was more expensive. Well, unless I'm mistaken, I think if you ask Mayor Richards when they come in and Chief Shepherd whether the city has actually saved overtime money, I think the response will, I'll be listening. You tell me when the show's on. But I think the response will be no. They have not saved a considerable amount of money. And in fact, I think what I've heard, and this comes from reliable sources, is that they've actually spent more money. Mm-hmm. Right. The second issue is in terms of logistics. How do you deploy your police officers? Well, again, it's a question of priorities. I understand and appreciate why Mayor Duffy might want to have had greater control over where officers were sent. But I think as a result of that decision, that priority to control where police officers are, I think we lost control of our relationships with the community. Duffy, I remember I was an assistant district attorney, and I remember walking the streets with Duffy on Holzer Street, trying to stop crime and violence in that neighborhood. The connection that they had with him is a connection that our cops are not being afforded to have today, because they're assigned to these big, huge section offices, and they can't connect with the people the way he did. He came in under a community policing strategy. We don't have that anymore because of those two section offices.
It would be interesting to see if we could possibly blend the two concepts into a working compromise, and maybe that's a discussion that we should have, and we'll have a chance to have that very discussion next week. Our number right now, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm Bob Smith with Tariq Spence, my partner on this program, who is, of course, best known as the host of the Wake Up Club on WDKX here in Rochester. The topic, Race, Are We So Different?, a continuing series of programs that are inspired by the Rochester Museum and Science Center's exhibit of that very title. And as a matter of fact, this hour we're talking about an aspect of that with Rochester School Board member, attorney, and author Van White. And of course, we're talking with you if you dial in at 263-WXXI. Let's go to Mike in the city right now. Hello, Mike. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Well, Mike evidently is not ready to be with us right at the moment. We'll hold him in reserve and go on to Brandon in Rochester. Brandon, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
We're doing well, thanks. How are you?
I've been trying to get in touch with Van White, actually. I had a I had a couple of questions. I'm a resident of Rochester, and I had recently was involved with a case with a couple of officers. I know I can't say any names, but I'm going to just refer to certain things. I got pulled over at about 12:30, February 29th of 2012, by some officers on Clinton. And me and only these officers were on the street at that time. They said that they were behind me. I didn't make the correct signal within 100 yards before I made it to the corner. So what happened was they ended up pulling me over. What really happened was they was on the other side of the street and they made a U-turn and got behind me. And then I turned the corner, and as I turned the corner, they turned the lights on and they got behind me. So once they walked up to the car, they asked for my license, which I gave them. I was in a rental car. It was my birthday weekend. So I told them, I said, this is not my car. It's a rental, but it's rented to me. They said, can you provide me with the rental agreement, which I did. I reached the apartment and gave them that. So once I did that, he asked me to step out of the car before he even checked my license or anything. Me knowing that my license and stuff was valid, thinking that it's just procedure, I stepped out of the car. Hmm. So he said, do you mind if I check the car or whatever? So I said, what's going on? He was like, I smell marijuana. So I was like, well, I don't smoke, so I smell marijuana. He was like, well, I smell marijuana strongly coming from the car, whatever. So we went through that for a couple of minutes. So eventually they ended up putting me in handcuffs. Now, I understand what you're saying about sometimes it's procedure for them to put you in cuffs because they get into squabbles and stuff with people, but it was nine of them, and it was only me by myself. They put me in cuffs to put me at a disadvantage. So I stood there. He unbuckled my pants. Told me how. Who is it? Told me how he was tactical, and a tactical unit can do whatever they want to do, and all this other stuff. So I was like, okay, all right, whatever. Me not thinking that he's about to strip me in the middle of the street. I stood there. Mm. He unbuckled my pants. Now, mind you, I'm handcuffed. My pants is falling down on my knees. I can't do anything. So he searches me. He opens my pants. He looks around my genital areas first. He didn't see anything, so he closed my pants up. I wear boxer briefs. They have a little pocket up inside of them. So what he did was he went up inside the pocket. He retrieved some things from there that wasn't supposed to be in there. But I was asking him, like, you know, why are you searching me like this if your only reason for pulling me over was for pulling me over because I didn't signal before I was supposed to? So long story short, I ended up going to court. Now, I'm supposed to be copping out to 2.5 years.
What was the charge?
The charge was criminal possession in the third degree.
Okay.
All right, so did they find something?
They actually did. But now what I ended up finding out, at this officer was involved in a case where he said a gentleman ran through a stop sign, he pulled him over, that resulted in him finding drugs and a gun. But that case got thrown out because they actually got on the stand under oath and lied and said that this gentleman ran a stop sign, which clear as day, a Rochester video showed that he didn't. He stopped right at the stop sign.
So the video evidence is, and we talk about this all the time, Van, that the feeling is of, okay, if he were wrong here, could he be wrong in this case? Could he be wrong in other cases? Could he be wrong?
And I want to know, how was he still even on the streets? Yeah. This was, when he arrested me, this was like 8 months after the fact. So how was he even still patrolling after he had already got up on the stand and committed perjury? I don't understand that.
What Tariq will tell you, we hear stories all the time about police officers and how they commit acts that for us would amount to major crimes. You know, people allege, they call us up and they say a police officer assaulted them. They call up and say police officers lied on the stand, like this gentleman. The reality is there is a system in place. We talk about this all the time. It's called professional standards. In the movies and TV, they call it internal affairs. Our version is called professional standards. And if there's a complaint about how an officer treated someone in the courtroom, or how they treated someone in the community, There's a process for that that is in place to evaluate the conduct of that officer. I can tell you over the years that I've been on the water cooler and over the years that I've been involved that there's some frustration even with that system about the credibility of that system. And so it just adds into – but let me just say on this scenario that you've described, it sounds all too typical, right? Mm. I just did a major trial. A guy was charged with two major felony counts. What began the encounter, listen to this, Bob. I don't know if you heard this, and I know, Tariq, you've heard it. Mm. Driving down the street, stoplight, right? My client was stopped. The basis for the stop was failure to turn on his signal 100 feet before the stop.
Same thing, right?
Now, how many of us, you don't have to call in, but how many of us actually measure or even come close to turning on our turn signal 100 feet before the stop? And it's not like my client, not like this gentleman didn't stop. He stopped. My client stopped. Mm-hmm. And then turned on his turn signal. Well, as he was waiting there, he turned on his turn signal and then took the left-hand turn. But the basis for the original stop was failing to signal 100 feet before the stop. And my client doesn't know this guy from Adam. I've never heard this guy before, right? Mm-hmm. He said I haven't called him back, right? My client has stopped. Officer says the same thing. Smells the pungent smell of marijuana emanating from the car. My client didn't smoke no marijuana. Why are all these stories repeatedly the same? Why are they experiences? Why are men?
And this is my question.
Kurt, so I guess is the moral of the story basically when he says, "Can I search your car?" I say, you should say, "I'll be happy to as soon as you bring me the warrant."
No. The moral of the story is you say no, you be respectful, you don't run away, because, I talk about that in FN. Yeah. But let me step back, that there's another moral to the story, mm-hmm. and I don't want to offend this guy. And I'm not condoning what this officer did or what the officer did in the case that we just got the acquittal, mm-hmm. right? The jury understood what happened. 12 people, this community, only one black person on that jury understood what happened and acquitted my client. But there's another story that has to be told here, mm-hmm. and I don't want to be offensive, but I do.
No,
so
I'm going to go there.
You know why? Too, why? You know, and I'm trying to hang this guy on a cross or hang him from some other place. But why do you have drugs in your car? If you want to make sure that police don't mess with you or have the opportunity to take control of your life, don't have drugs in your car. Now, maybe the drugs got there, and this gentleman doesn't know how, and hopefully, prayerfully, have a good, if he hasn't had already, a good defense team. But one of the things we need to tell ourselves in our community is, if you want to make sure the police act right, don't act right yourself. In other words, I say this, I've said this for years mm-hmm. under the water cooler. Mm-hmm. The surest way to lose control, to have someone take control of your life, is to lose control of your life. So if you got drugs in your life, you're going to lose control, and sure enough, somebody will take control.
And there is still a legal end of it that needs to be taken care
absolutely.
Of.
Absolutely.
And that's what but that's the scary part. No, but that's the reality of it. Like, you still have this sort of legal issue.
I'm being offered 2 years for this right now. That's what what I'm trying to find
out.
Well,
no, that's something between you and your lawyer. You got to talk to your lawyer about this.
I know, but what I'm thinking is, I talked to somebody the other day who is like, I know Duffy very well. I used to be in a tool and die program that he started up right before he left. Mm-hmm. I know him very well, first name basis. If you hear my name, he knows me very well. So, you know, like, I understand that, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a procedure and internal affairs and all that. But, I mean, like, I was talking to somebody, and they were saying, like, you know, it got to start somewhere. Somebody has to take a stand. And my stand would be me either taking his 2.5 on a cop out or going to trial and blowing for 6. But you said you just had somebody that went to trial and they won trial.
But there's two trials. There's two. But here's, let's be fair. There's two trials here. Yeah. There is the ethics of the officer, which is one that could get the charge dropped, but there is still the possession charge.
But let me tell you, you're right. There's two proceedings,
two different worlds here
where the discussion of race can take part. The one is, and you heard the guy say it over there, the suppression hearing. The suppression hearing is basically, was there a justification for the stop? That's where you usually hear about probable cause and whether they were right in stopping. Yep. And let me just tell you, let's be honest. In the court of law, when you're in a courtroom and an officer testifies, he didn't stop 100 feet before the stoplight, and the judge can look in a statute book and find out there is such a law, even though nobody uses it. If the judge can take the testimony of a police officer, and the police officer says, when he rolled down that window, I smelled marijuana. Whether that client takes a stand at a suppression hearing or not, I'm going to tell you, the reality is the judge is going to believe the police officer. Yeah. Unless, of course, there is a video. Now, there was a video in that case and the other case that he referred to, and it showed that the person did stop at the stop sign. So that that destroyed the credibility of that police officer. There are other instances where that happens. There was a cop in New York City who testified at a probable cause hearing as to why he had stopped the particular African-American male. I talked about this in one article. It was just recently in New York City. He got on his cell phone. The cop did not know. Mm-hmm. He was under investigation for some kind of insurance fraud. So the feds or somebody had a wire on his phone. Mm-hmm. He gets on the phone after he successfully testifies at the probable cause hearing as to why he had stopped this guy. The guy is now looking at some serious felony charge because of the officer's testimony. It's going to go to trial, just like this guy. The cop gets on his phone, calls his girlfriend, and says, "Yeah, I just fried another beep," the N-word, right?
Yeah.
They caught that, and that's a rare instance where a cop, a person who happens to be a cop, is caught in his lie. So the first phase that you deal with racism and issues is the suppression hearing. My client contested. The client that just got the acquittal, he contested the circumstance of the stop. Just as I said, the judge said, well, the law book says I never was stopped for arrested for failing to stop 100 feet. But the judge said that's the reason for the stop. The judge credited the testimony of police officers to what he saw when the client or smelled when the client rolled down the window. And it was a done deal. Now, then we had to go to that second part, which was a trial. And there, that's the beauty of the American system. Then you can go before your peers. Your peers don't always have to be the same color. Mm. And you make your case to them. And we were able to make a case, and those 12 people acquitted. Now, let me say, I don't know what this gentleman's case involves. Mm-hmm. You can't equate this case to his case.
To everyone. But the understanding and the belief of it all. And you've mentioned this before in effort, too, the decisions that African-Americans, that we as a culture make. Okay, I didn't do anything wrong. It, theoretically, if you listen to
it. I want to know, did that guy win his, did he not win his suppression hearing?
He did not win his suppression hearing. We had to go to trial.
Yeah. But you still have to go through the whole process. But therein lies the issue, the belief in the process that it'll work.
Right.
That's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. Right. And two, the things that we're doing to ourselves, let's be honest, we're not supposed to be doing anything that we know is wrong. We know it puts us in jeopardy for the stop to be legitimized. The stop is illegitimate until they find something that they believe that we've had that we know we shouldn't have.
Well, I do thank you. And you know what, Brandon? I wish you well. I wish the best of luck to you right now. Just before I go on to the next call, I'm going to put one question out on the table. If that had been me behind the wheel, would the cop have even noticed or cared or done anything except let me go by?
Well, if the cop was racially profiling, the statistics say you would have just gone by. Again, you see a pattern here, and you have to begin to wonder whether African-American boys who are being stopped on their bicycles because they don't have horns is related to their race. And then let's be honest. Let's have a complete discussion about this. To what extent? And I'm a civil rights lawyer. I sue the police department probably more than most lawyers do. And I don't take any pride in that. I do that because I'm trying to effectuate change, right? And the reason why I don't take any pride in that is there are many, et cetera, good police officers than there are bad ones. But it's like the bad apple spoils the bunch. Yeah. But having said all that and raised those cases, the other question we have to have this conversation about race, to be fair, is what are we doing that would draw unnecessary attention to us? The number one cause of death for an African-American male is not a white man in a white hood with little eyes cut out, but another black man, same age, right? Yeah. So there is some conversation that has to take place that is balanced. But that doesn't mean, just because we sometimes are engaging in inappropriate behavior, that doesn't mean that people who are sworn to serve and protect can therefore violate people's rights. That's the fine line the cops are running, but it should be very clear that you cannot treat people of color differently and arrest just black boys on bikes without horns on them just because they're black boys.
263 WXXI, 263-9994. I'm Bob Smith with Tariq Spence, and our guest this hour is Van White, Rochester School Board member, attorney, and author. His latest book, entitled F it. Yes, that's the title that I can say.
I think you enjoy saying that.
well,
it makes Bob a little risque, you know?
That's as risque as we ever get around here.
I'll tell you.
But the thing is, I guess it expresses the frustration that a lot of people have. And we go back to the phones. We're going to hear from Willa in Rochester. And hi, Willa, you're on the air.
Taking my call, Bob.
Okay, glad to be there. We'll look forward, by the way. I know I'm talking with Willa Powell, also of the Rochester School Board, the Finance Committee Chair, and Willa. We'll be talking about dollars and cents next week on this program, 1 week from today. But what's on your mind today?
Well, thanks. Actually, it's a sort of a preview of that. I wanted to explore the concept, the sort of the macro sociology concept that you've been talking in a micro form. You know, once upon a time, cities were a place where all of the wealth of this nation resided and industry and so on. And, you know, as people of color fled to the cities, the, you know, the wealth of the cities declined through white flight and green flight. And the policies of the state haven't caught up with that. They made no effort to catch up with that. And so as our tax base has dwindled, we still have laws and funding streams in New York State that were designed specifically to help our suburban neighbors who were growing faster than they could, you know, in terms of building schools and so on, growing faster than their tax base could immediately support. Now we have urban districts all over the state and country whose tax base cannot support basic function. And, you know, you were talking earlier about the concept that the way the police department restructured was designed to save money, and whether it really happened or not is debatable. But the fact is that our city, like our school district, doesn't have enough resources to do its basic functions. And part of the reason is that we have this property tax-based system that the state seems to think is okay.
So we should upgrade. We should sort of change the structure based on what we're dealing with now as opposed to 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly my point. Mm-hmm. And so the behavior of our legislators who fail to recognize this basic inequity in resources makes me wonder if there isn't an institutional racism that goes all the way to the top, including our governor, who is proposing a budget that doesn't bring about equitable funding for schools, that in fact dances around equitable funding for schools and offers instead competitive grants, which means we're going to have winners and losers.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the points that Willa has made repeatedly, and I give her credit because she's almost like a John the Baptist in the wind, is that these the urban districts in particular are underfunded. They set out all these mandates for us to accomplish, mm-hmm. and yet we don't have the resources to accomplish them. And this in light of the fact that the Court of Appeals ruled with respect to that case in New York City that the state...
Oh, Dan, can I...
Yes.
Can I tell you something that I learned recently?
Uh-huh.
In 1993, when the CFE case first started in New York City, mm-hmm. the school funding formula allotted less than one per pupil unit to New York City kids. I mean, does that sound like 5/8 of a person?
Right.
I mean, that's essentially what started the CFE case in New York City.
And in that case, as Willa will tell you, she's been trying to tell other people that it's very clear that the Court of Appeals said you got to do a better job at more equitably distributing the state resources to support urban schools. Mm-hmm. And to sort of bring the conversation full circle, because both you guys mentioned my book, people resign themselves to frustration and failure when they don't believe that resources or individuals treat them in a respectful a dignified way.
Less than.
And, less than people.
Yeah.
And that, there is, as Will has just suggested, there's some historical precedent for that. And more recently, we find that the Court of Appeals says you got to treat urban centers more equitably, more fairly. And when people are repeatedly confronted by police officers, mayors, governors, whoever, whatever title they wear, and they're not treated respectfully and with dignity, they get to the point where they say, F it. You know, you don't have to say that word. You can just say, forget it, screw it, whatever. They throw their hands up in the air and they say, forget it. Hmm. And as public officials, we have to be mindful, from the mayor's office to the school board to the governor's position, and be mindful that we have a responsibility to treat people with dignity and thereby bring them hope. And then let me just say, the balance side of this is individuals who are the subject of that mistreatment have to keep hope in their lives by making the right choices, like not engaging in drug trafficking, like being respectful to your spouse, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. Because there are choices that we make that hurt our ability to have hope in our lives.
And one of those is not going to school, which is one of the things I know you guys on the board have been talking a lot about.
And that's self-destructive, but then again, it's understandable, an outcrop of frustration. Will, I thank you. Look forward to talking with you further on this next week. 1370 Connection continues on WXXI. I'm Bob Smith with Tariq Spence. We are talking with Van White, school board member, attorney, and author, as we continue our conversation, Race, Are We So Different?, inspired by the Rochester Museum and Science Center's exhibit. And we have, right now, Yolanda on the line. Hi, Yolanda, you're on the air.
Thank you. How are you all?
We're doing well, thanks.
Very well.
Good, thank you. Actually, as I've been waiting and listening to the last, say, 10, 15 minutes of the program, and I did join the program late, the point that I wanted to make has been touched on several times, most notably by, I believe, Van White is the voice that I was hearing. And I did want to reiterate that, you know, as I'm a mother of two African-American children. I'm African-American myself. I've also been a teacher in the city school district and various other districts for about a total of about 15 years. And I'm currently now an attorney myself. So I sort of have seen this issue in this community. I've been in the Rochester community now in all of those capacities for the last almost 25 years. And I have seen many times patterns that I find that I have to try to educate my own children on so that they don't fall prey to the institutional racism of the system, to these types of encounters with law enforcement. Time and time again, I see young African-American males and females conducting themselves in public in such a fashion that is abhorrent, that is, you know, disrespectful of authority. And these types of behaviors and the conduct, when we don't try to steer our young people in the proper direction, in an appropriate direction for how to engage with authority, these types of behaviors perpetuate the stereotypical myth. And the what happens then, I believe, is that law enforcement officials who are encountering this type of conduct on a regular basis, their profiling is being informed by the patterns of experiences that they have had and that they continue to have encountering our young folks or our black males, be it young or old. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice as a community not to look at ourselves and say, hey, I would help to not perpetuate this myth if I didn't have drugs on me when I get pulled over. I may help to not perpetuate this myth if when the police officer pulls me over, I'm respectful and that I'm cooperative. My own son, by way of an example, he's a student at Buff State University. And he was recently not exercising proper judgment, out with some friends. He plays on the rugby team, and they were doing what rugby.
You can stop right there. I already know. Yeah, yeah.
and he decided to walk home back to his apartment, but on the way, not having worn a jacket and being somewhat inebriated, he decided to get into a parked car. He says to keep himself warm. Lo and behold, he was descended on by about four or five vehicles. Somebody had seen him get into the car, and by all accounts was treated horribly. At the outset, you know, with immediate suspicion that he was attempting to steal something from the vehicle or commit some kind of crime inside of the vehicle. And thankfully, in spite of his level of inebriation, he was able to remember the lessons that I have, you know, tried to instill in him about being respectful, being cooperative, you know, name, rank, and serial number, but, you know, just, but be polite. And that's what he did. And in the end, this matter was dismissed, and time again, in fact, the charges that were finally, he was finally charged with, almost, it was a joke because it was easily dismissible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what we think is that the police officer was appreciative of his conduct, of his level of cooperation, and, you know, his demeanor during the process.
He didn't escalate it, basically.
And it got him out of the situation. I can't tell you how many times I've been stopped, and, you know, probably rightfully so, but was allowed to go on my way because I was, you know, polite and appropriate and cooperative. And I think that we have to look at our own behaviors and the things that we're doing that help perpetuate the myth.
It's so interesting. I don't mean to cut you off. It's so interesting you said it because she reminds me of my mom, the same sort of thing. You have to understand that, you know, this is why you need good grades. You have a strike against you. You have to realize this is why, if you're caught in a situation or if you're in a situation, why you have to look them in the eye, answer the questions properly, understand what you're doing. And Van, I can almost see her telling this story, and I could see a white male, man, he's just a crazy college kid, and this is what these college kids do. But if you see a black male, you see, okay, why did he go in that car? What is he looking for? Yeah. And it's the two different stories that you have to understand that African Americans are dealing with, in a sense that I could see both of those. One is a teen movie that you know could end with a laugh or two, and the other could end with a Hughes Brothers film. You know what I mean? And those are the two different things that we don't talk enough about.
But the solutions, in talking about solutions, the solutions have to be, as this caller suggests, two level. And I talk about this in the book, and the full title is "Effort Frustration in America." The solution in that dialogue has to be about the decisions we make, you know, whether to drink such to the extent that you lose total control of your body, right? Your total sense of your judgment, everything that your mom taught you, you go open up a stranger's car door. That's a bad decision. And the mom has conceded that, and I assume her son has conceded that. Then the other thing we have to talk about to fix the terrible problem we have with race relations is choices that we make, right? And then decisions that government officials make. How does a police officer respond to a black male vis-a-vis a white male in a situation like that? So, again, first level dialogue has to be, what choices did we make to get ourselves in this predicament? And then the second one is, what decisions do decision makers make that maybe exacerbate the problem of hopelessness?
Both good questions. I wish we had much more time to talk about right now. My thanks to Van White. My thanks to my co-host for the hour, Tariq Spence. And my thanks to all of you for listening to 1370 Connection from WXXI AM and FM HD2 Rochester. For Dave Campo, our technical director of the WXXI TV crew, I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure.